This is another presentation of Tape Recorded UFO Information Service. The lecture is a portion of the Long John program, heard on November the 25th, 1956, on WOR in New York. Ivan T. Sanderson is a distinguished naturalist, author, and explorer, and he turns to a question asked by hundreds of thousands, what are the UFOs? Sanderson brings a trained scientific mind to the study of this important question as he gives his biological theory of the UFOs. And now here is Mr. Sanderson.
Let's get off the reporting and let's start something. That's the man I want to speak to. That I'm going to speak very frankly, and I may get a little rough sometimes. I hope, as always, I will remain within the bounds of not naturally common decency, but tact. Let us dispose of various problems first of all, and I must explain. Well, I should explain. I'm sick to death of my good pals and physicists. The woods is full of them. Everybody is. Physicists and mathematicians today have
I might add that he is not a physicist. That was a wrong introduction on my part.
This is not against your guess last night, but I'm speaking now. I'm off the Major case. I'm off Dr. Davidson. I'm off the Flatwoods case and everything. Let's get into this whole business.
You're on Ivan.
I'm on the subject of UFOs and a lot more besides. And let me start at the beginning. We are a technological culture in this country and in the Western world. And the whole world is becoming that way. Now, our technology, this is the first development, founded on what is called physics. Not only the physical sciences, but physics. And the physicists are most honored amongst the scientists today. At least, I suppose, mathematicians on top, to the kind of theory. And then the physicists, and then down to the chemists. Us poor little biologists are sort of tagging along. Now, I would just like to point out that I don't know if you know this. Many people in this country don't realize, by my vulnerable accent, to realize that I was born and brought up on the other side. I discovered to my dumbfounded amazement only a few years ago that what we call popularly in this country sound, not sound at all, it's technology, gadgetry, artisanship for the most part. What we call philosophy in this country is what's called pure sound for the rest of the world. And what the rest of the world calls philosophy, we call metaphysics in this country.
Right.
All right? Well, let's get things straight. Now, about 99% of physicists, and I'm not saying anything against them, are gadgeteers. They're not scientists at all. Merely by matter of semantics, it only takes one Fermi to devise, think out the principles of an atom bomb. It takes 100,000 people to put one together. And we live in an age when it's the people who put bombs together that matter. We almost worship them. And I think to the enormous credit of the physicists who, underpaid as they are, overworked as they are, have not yet founded an orthodoxy or a hierarchy, nor are they bullying people around. They're trying to do a hard job. But they're not scientists. And like chemists, about 25% are probably real scientists. Do you know what the definition of science is? We look it up even in Webster. It is the exploration or investigation of the unknown, not of the known. Technology, from technos, you look that up in the Greek dictionary, you'll find out that it actually comes down to the further elaboration of, or understanding of, or logos, knowledge of the known, or technos. Technoi, I think it is, but anyhow. Now, many are really working in the field of pure sound. In other words, it starts with imagination, just like science fiction does, following which comes a hypothesis, out of which may develop a theory, after which you test the theory, and if it works out, you finally have practice. The chemists are examining real things. Do you realize that the only thing that doesn't exist, the only thing that we know for sure is absolutely true, and that's mathematics. Mathematics, we can't say that word tonight. There is no such a thing as mathematics in nature outside of an intelligent human-type mind. Doesn't exist. If you add five apples to two apples, three apples to two apples, you don't get five apples. There's just a lot of apples lying on the ground. Mathematics is a very peculiar business, but it is the only thing that's actually true
and can actually, in every case, be proved right or wrong, despite that horrible little figure, which means possibility, which has now crept in, and infinity. But it's a pet science. It's the only thing that doesn't really exist. Physics is the next one down. Do you know a certain physicist, who will not mention his name, who was one of the people who helped put the atom bomb together, pointed out to me not so very long ago that when they let off the first experimental atom bomb at Alamogordo, we knew of the existence of 14 less particles in the nucleus than we know now. So really, we're fiddling around with something we didn't know very much about. So you have a lot of theoreticians, or a few theoreticians, people who put this stuff together, and then a mass of technologists. Then you come down to the chemists. Finally, you come down to the biologists. And biology is totally a little forgotten science, although it's becoming of vital importance. After all, biology is dealing with facts, which are studying from ourselves on up and on down. And they, the majority of them still have to be scientists. There's a lot of biological technology going on. But on the whole, the biologist has to be a little bit more scientific, shall we say, about it. I'm not being snide. I'm simply trying to put the thing. It's a matter of semantics and nothing else. But a lot of people don't understand it. They think that mending radio sets and putting atom bombs together is science. It's not. Gadgeteering of a very advanced order. The army wants a bigger bang than the Russians have got. You get 100,000 people together. You dig the things out of the ground. You put them together in a certain kind of way, and you get your big bang. But the Fermis of this world and the people who think of the theory and develop the theory are exploring the unknown. Now, there's been some little scientific respect shown to this whole subject of what I call ufology. And I think it's about time that one of the sciences could find time or space or place to allow this strange subject to be taken in. The meteorologists don't want it. They're far too busy. And they're concerned with things in our sky, so see, which they have to know about. The astronomers don't want any part of it. Anyhow, they can't see half these things as reported because they're either too far away or too close up. And they don't fit into their scheme of things. The physicists don't want them at all, just because they're part of physics. The chemists are only interested in the chemistry of the sky at all. And so on down the line. The biologists, least of all, the few people, have simply, well, it's obviously not to do with us. And so really, it's a psychologist, a psychiatrist. They say, well, it's bad liquor, mass hallucination, deflated navy blimps. I don't know why. The sea monster thing. That's one of the great explanations of sea monsters. Deflated navy blimps. The poor navy must have been getting rid of blimps at the rate of about 400 a year for the last 100 years. But all these kind of they're really very silly, let's face it. Here, there have been what dear old Charles Fort used to call OSM, objects seen floating. I think it's a much nicer connotation to UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Objects seen floating, gently or otherwise, in the sky. I would point out that nowadays they're always dashing about in the sky, whereas in the early days they seem to have been just floating there rather gently. But these types of things have been seen throughout history. And don't think that it's all Fort and newspaper reports. Fort started picking up reports for his book. He took an archive date of 1800. A couple of other gentlemen you mentioned before, Jessup and so on, have dug out reports in Wilkinson. I don't remember if it's Wilkinson or Wilkinson. I hope it's not named. Anyhow, everybody who is interested in this thing will know who I'm talking about. It's gone way back to early Chinese literature. There's quite a bunch of the Bible, you know. Not only the flying wheel in the sky, but Isaiah being taken up in the fiery chariot. People wanted it in those days. They weren't frightened of what somebody was going to tell them. That you're lying, you're a hoaxer, all that. What they thought, they said, and they got into print, if there was any print available. The ancient Egyptians have certain very peculiar things they've taken, but much more important than that. And I would ask you, and any of you listeners, just go out to the New York Public Library. Get a hold of the proceedings of the Royal Society of London, starting with its inception in the late 1700s, and going on up to about 1865, just ruffle through the pages of those proceedings. You will find story after story reported to the Royal Society of London by members of the Royal Society of all kinds of dreary things being seen in the sky. As I said before, about the only shape that never seems to have once been reported yet is that of a saucer. Lenses, things that look like the bottom of lamps, lozenge-shaped jobs, not quite the square things, cylinders, things that look like kites, cigar-shaped objects, lights of all kinds, objects with lights on them, and so on. I really don't think that anybody, except for possibly gentlemen of the press, and I can't think why they're so against it, any longer really laugh at the fact of there being a lot of things buzzing about in the sky or having been seen in the sky. I mean, to turn around and say it's all nonsense, it's just absurd. On the 13th of October, I stood with 10,000 people out on that road watching this alleged balloon. My eyesight's fine, of course. I didn't have any field glasses. It looked awful funny to me. If it was a balloon, it was one ticket for the big one. It certainly wasn't that little 4-foot job, which was let off in Long Island. Because it was in the sky, nearly 100 miles away, half an hour before that one was let off. If it was a skyhook that was let off out in Minnesota or wherever they're doing it now, there's a private corporation that's doing it out there, they won't tell us if one was let off, and they won't tell us if the wind was in the wrong direction. So it was a balloon. A lot of people looked at it through field glasses. It had something hanging down underneath, all right. But the whole thing, despite the fact that they finally wiped it away, as Carl talked about saying, it was a balloon. We know it was a balloon. All right, but in the meantime, all these snide remarks about it, it must have been a balloon. It can't be anything else. Everybody doesn't know what they see, and there's tens of thousands of people looking at it. You get all these reports in scientific journals, and the Royal Society of London, a pretty spirited-minded organization, and all this has, I think, been credited as being there. And here they have them in their official journal. You can find them in several meteorological journals. What's that read for? He's not all newspaper clippings, you know. He gives his little references in an awfully funny way, but the references are there. And I've spent days, spent maybe cut out 4 copies of Charles Fort and card index and cross-index every single statement of the nature of those things which I'm particularly interested in on a card index. And I did a lot of sitting in the library after I'd been ill for a time, asking for these different journals, not newspapers, and seeing that the things are really in there. And they're there, all right. One of the pieces, funny enough, where the actual pages had been torn out of the journals right in the public library. We had to send for a second set and a third set before we could find the proper pagination, and there was the story. But it all seems to have come to an end in the Royal Society, for instance, about 1870. They had a wonderful president called Sir David Brewster, who seemed to have had an extremely open mind, in the better sense of that word, and that he allowed these things to be published. But about that time, you see, science, or rather, technology, was getting going, becoming patternized. And you couldn't have things outside the textbook. It upsets the system. I mean, after all, the series, geological series, has always been laid down. You couldn't suddenly ask for another 2 million years jandy between the Oligocene and the Eocene, for instance. It would upset the whole picture. And until somebody could actually come up and show you a huge block of rock that went in there, the thing is ignored. In other words, they said, look, let's concentrate on what has to be done to get on with technology. We can have scientific thinking forever. So we've got to all the sciences, and that seems to work. We'll get rid of the rest. It's a purely historical gesture, as it were. Now, with great cause, let me explain why. Am I sort of pontificating too much?
No,
there is indeed a reason for it. Science has a methodology. In addition to being the investigation of the unknown, I doubt if you'll ever get a thing like the occult received into the body of pure science, because I'm not interested in the occult. I'm interested in everything. Incidentally, I might throw in that one thing my short life has taught me, that a lot of things are improbable, so I don't think anything is impossible. Now, the occult, I don't think, will be included in science because it is not open to measurement, which means, in its widest sense, that if a man says, I have invented a vaccine to polio, not only has that vaccine got to prevent polio, but somebody else, using his published account of how he prepared that vaccine, has got to be able to do it in another time and place and come up with the same result. If somebody says, I saw a flying disc over Oregon at 9:10 on the 11th, there's not much you can do about it, because it's not a scientific statement insofar that you can't reproduce the disc at any other place at the same time. That's a very crude way of putting it, and I'm stretching the rubber band as far as I can to try and make my point. Science is precise. You've got to be able to weigh and measure the object. At least you've got to be able to reproduce it on the mark. Dr. J.B. Ryan ran into that great difficulty when he was working on EFT. It seemed to come on and go off without any kind of regularity. You couldn't definitely say to me, "Guy, look, I've got the following results." And on paper, statistically, with this gentleman sitting in front of me, and with a girl in a room, four rooms away, and then get up and walk out in another investigative takeover, it's probably going to just be so. Just to come on and go off. It's going to be very difficult in those borderline investigations. However, the ufology, I believe, is a very much more practical thing than that. I believe it would eventually, or could eventually, be subject to a proper analysis and probably measurement in time if people would take the thing seriously. I don't know whether any of the air forces, particularly the Swedes and the Peruvians, I continue to stress, because those are the two great areas in the world where these things have become so very, very numerous. I know that the British have grabbed a lot of strange substances that have fallen out of the sky because of actual police reports of it, and I think they are also pretty interested. But as I say, once again, we give credit to our Air Force for having come out and done something about it. I don't think that if they're not to be censored for covering up, if it's anything, it's the other way. They've done a wonderful job trying to find out something and putting out these lucrative reports and so on. We'll cover those details, Arthur. I don't fix up in that. But we have overlooked one major fact in trying to be what I'd like to call scientific about it, or at least objective and logical about it. Everybody's dashing about with preconceived ideas, and all of them that I've heard on your program recently have been ideas stemming from physics with a little bit of chemistry thrown in, a great deal of cloak and dagger stuff, and a certain amount of publishing business, and all the rest of it. Not one single person has really used their minds and said, now, in the overall, what could these things be? Now, you think I'm going to jump right off this subject for a moment? Say something rather funny. You take me outside where the Carteret here. We're not too far away from the turnpike. It's perfectly ordinary soil between here and there, despite all the oil. You dig me up any cubic yard of soil, I take soil or anything else for that matter, any way you like. You give it to me to take to a certain lab, and give me a little bit of money, pay some technicians, to examine that cubic yard of soil. I said a yard, isn't it? Cubic yard by yard by yard. I think I'm right in saying, and podologists and various others, virologists and so on, may correct me, but I would say there are 10,000 different kinds of life forms in that one block of soil. By the time you've taken the bacteria, and the little worms, the little insects, and the eggs, and the funguses, and all the rest of it. Well, perhaps I'm exaggerating. I don't know. I may be taking a touch of that. But there are thousands of different kinds of life forms living right in that one little bit of soil. Now, the different life forms on the surface of this earth are absolutely incredible. There are about a million species of living animals which have Latin names already. The entomologists, the bug hunters, the insect people. Insects alone, mind you, I'm not talking of crustaceans or the spider group, the arachnids or the centipedes, which are also jointed-legged animals. But the insects alone are half that number, 500,000. And the entomologists assure us that we've only got about one-ninth of those yet to be discovered on the surface of this earth. That's insects alone. The 25,000 species of known species of beetles in the British Isles alone. I may astonish you to know that there are 822 species and subspecies of mammals indigenous to North America, the United States, of which over half are rats in the wide sense, rats and mice. Now, this business of UFOs, everybody thinks it's their flying saucers, this or that. They are probably of such innumerable different kinds and different origins that it'll take an enormous science to do anything about it, simply to catalogue these two things. And I absolutely refuse to give any opinion. Have you a point coming up? To say that they're, I certainly will definitely say they're not all one thing. They're not all two things. They're probably hundreds. Now, I'm going to put a rather fast one on you, John. We were talking about such interesting things of different nature coming out here tonight. I've got the finest set of UFO photographs, I'm sure, that you've ever seen right here. With them, I hope to make a point that I have been working up to. You may have guessed what it is. If you haven't, don't give it away to your listeners. I'm going to show you these photographs in a certain order. They are set up on cards And we'd have to do this. We'd have to do the video as well as the audio right here. They're set up on cards with a piece of with a little window cut in a cover. And I want to show you them to you one at a time. And if you have any violent comments, make them. But I'll turn you off if I think you're going the wrong way. This is demonstrating a point. May I pass it to Sylvia first? You pass them on to John. If you want to make any comments, that is, of course, an ordinary. That's, I would say, almost would be a Adamski style. You see the little round things underneath.
Mr. McKay, I assume that these are what you would call reliable accounts of fine objects.
No, I didn't say that. I said they're reliable, already published photographs, which I imagine the Air Force must have seen. They may have done, they may not have had the money to get on to it. Here is one of those jobs which has these portholes all around the side.
I think I know what it is, but I can't say anything.
All right. What do you think that is?
Is there some particular...
Well, doesn't that look like some
up or down? Mr. Lister, it doesn't make
sense. That's the bottom. That's right there. Now, here is a photograph of the same object taken with infrared and I think another light. They're mostly light. They're ones of light, of course.
Oh, I'm so tempted to this.
Hold it. There's another one. Now, that's the type which was first been seen down in Florida.
The only comment I can make at the moment is I've never seen any pictures like these, any photographs, as far as flying saucers are concerned.
Doesn't that look like...
An empty?
That type. The ones, and then the port light ones along the side.
Yes, and you might even call, you might even say this is a ping pong ball bait. A small one.
That's what I thought. Like
the air.
Mind you, there's a gag in this, not a trick, you see. Uh-huh. Do you remember the case in the South of France where these little things in pairs came out of that cylinder that Michel mentioned in his book? Do you remember that?
No.
Objects of that nature.
You mentioned the that I think they called it angel hair, was it?
That's it, and then the angel hair fell out of it. Of course, I have seen some of the ones. Photographs taken out west. As a matter of fact, part of the government bill, the color one, was taken by a friend of mine, Tex Ziegler, the round blue thing. Of course, this will give this away. Now you can set the last one. Well?
I'm guessing that. I guess that these are photographs of plant or animal life. Either the unknown object.
Open them up.
Yes.
Open up the top.
This one I don't want. These two I don't want to open. I want to see if I have been able to guess this. I suppose I haven't.
The Latin names are a little complicated down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. The first one that I showed is a sort of saucer-shaped object, luminous against a black background, right? With a few little round things underneath. The second one, I think, is this one, which is a series of little, look like little lights, rather hazy, in a circle, like port lights, with little streaks coming out. Now, I've got most of these matched to various types.
Well, have I set this by taking these?
No, those were the end. You keep them there. I mean, I'm just simply describing that they are lighted or luminous-looking objects on a dark ground. I've now asked John and Silver to open them up, and these are photographs of luminous animals. Some of them are very small size. This
lying or on the ground, primarily?
Nearly all in water.
In water.
But they're of all kinds. Now, this ring of little dots is actually a kind of grub, the female of a beetle found in South America, which incidentally has red and green light, sort of a stop and go bug. When it's curled out and taken in full darkness, all you see is this little ring of light. Now, this shaped object here, which looks like rather like an Adamski photograph, like a rather like, turns out to be a very small crustacean of a kind which is found in the sea off the coast of Japan. It happens to luminesce at night. It's semi-luminescent and so on. Now, I'm not bringing these things out to try and demonstrate. I'm not bringing them out to try and say that the photographs shown to you, for instance, were fake, or that they faked them by photographing these small luminous animals which are in every sea, in our woods, under a microscope, and then giving the photograph of luminous animals the same as the flying saucer.
Have these been published in any of the flying saucer books?
No, because no flying saucer book yet has ever come to what I'm building up to. They have never come to the
biological aspect of this thing. Now, these two here, I just wondered if I were if I was guessing this correctly. Are these a photograph of egg babies?
No. You may, at any time,
this here looks to me like the face of an egg beater, possibly set up on a piece of black velvet or photographic black paper, and just some light source on it.
May I explain, John, to your listeners, that I have presented these photographs stuck on cards with a piece of brown paper over that card, tipped on, with a window cut in it to show just this one photograph out of a series or a part of a photograph. By taking your lifting up the brown paper, you can see what they really are. They are pages taken out of Dr. Harvey's book on animal life, and they are all animals or vegetables which luminesce at night with chemiluminescence. The two that you were looking at are very small animals which are found in the sea of the jellyfish nature. They have in every way the appearance of many of the descriptions of different types of UFO. Now, I'm not saying that the photographs of UFOs that are being presented by such gentlemen as Mr. Adamski are photographs of this nature. We have got in front of us two types, or two methods by which photographs could be faked.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse at this point to say whether I think the photographs that have been printed or otherwise are faked or are not. That's another whole subject which I'd like to get off, if I may. I hope I've got you, and I hope I've got some of your millions of listeners to a point, of what, and I hope that it is also logical. I pointed out that life on the surface of our planet is incredibly, on the surface of our planet and in the waters of our planet, is incredibly complex. And the numbers of forms are just simply go on and on. There are millions of life forms. Leaving out all this photograph business for a moment, but I have shown you things here which I'm sure you've never seen before.
No, I have not.
Shape. They are called Radiolaria, Infusoria, Globigerina. They're huge groups of single-celled animals which are found in every drop of water practically in the world. Diatoms. Go into any biology class and lift a drop of ditch water and you'll see cylinders, lenticels, even saucers. Triangular things, yes, little saucer-like jugs, little plate-like jugs. Take some of your own blood and have a look at the platelets in it. They're little blind saucers. Really, too. The red blood corpuscles. In an acidic medium, it is preferable for an animal to adopt the most perfect of all forms, is the globular form, I presume. For purposes of locomotion or for sitting on the bottom or going up and down, they become compressed out of the top to bottom or from side to side. Then comes the question of tensile strength of the structure. Gelatinous ones just go like an amoeba. If they want to retain some kind of form, they will probably become hexagonal, triangular, dodecahedrons, tetrahedrons, or various geometric shapes. And these small animals that drift about, the plankton as it's known, which we may all have to feed on one day, which whales feed on, which most fishes feed on, is made up of millions of these little diatoms and things, and they're the most wonderful little shapes, because they float suspended in the water. And they take so long to sink, they never get anywhere, does it mean? Their whole life cycle is passed through in the sinking of a few feet, perhaps. Certain times of the year when the sea goes green, when lakes suddenly go sort of reddish, that is when you have what's called a flush of maybe bacteria or infusoria or one of these small protozoa type animals, or bacteria in some cases, some luminous bacteria. Have you ever opened your refrigerator and found a fish that you've got in there for the next day glowing happily in the dark? I have. It's the most alarming experience. That is the type of bacteria which lodges in the fish's scales. Those individual little bacteria are so small, you cannot see, of course, with the naked eye. You have to get a quite powerful microscope to see each individual little one. They put out continuous cold light throughout their tiny little lives, which, in proportion to their size, is about 400 times that of the power that goes into New York City. Nature is a very, very wonderful thing. Now, I'm coming finally to my point. Why I brought these things up was to point out that the biologist has not yet had a say in this UFO business. Now, I must give credit to a Swedish gentleman who I've never met. I don't know who he is or where he is. His name is spelled Zoe, which I understand is the Polish way of saying Joe. Wasilko, Wasilko, hyphen Zarecki, Serecki. I have talked about this myself a couple of times on the air, but very tangentially. This gentleman has developed a theory, and I give full credit to him for bringing it to my attention. I've been working on it for a year, but when I say working on it, I've been thinking of aspects of it and putting them down in, I hope, logical sequence. You know that animals feed on matter, material. Plants, on the other hand, feed half on matter and half on energy. They take substances in liquid form out of the soil through their roots, and they combine sunlight by the use of chlorophyll and the energy of the sunlight, combining with chemicals to build up their food substances in which they build their bodies. So we have life forms on the surface of this earth which are living on matter entirely, or half matter and half energy. Now, nothing is impossible in nature. It's highly probable that there could be life forms. I'm not talking about animals, or viruses, or plants, but another type, a fourth type of life form, which feeds exclusively on energy. Where is energy of certain kinds to be obtained in its purest form? Well, of course, all matter is energy, basically. But it's kind of locked up energy, isn't it? We're finding that out now with our fusion and our fission bombs. It takes an awful lot of power to get the locked up energy out of matter, or get it, or put it back in and gather it up and stick it in to make the matter stick together in fusion. Where is a lot of free energy of certain kinds available? At the outer limit of our atmosphere, where such energy is pouring upon us from the sun, for instance, but the many other sources that we find now from radio astronomy. This Polish gentleman's initial suggestion was that there may be life forms living up there of a highly tenuous nature, which are enclosed in a bladder-type thing, which for some reason, and I think he has good reason for saying this, and I just have a lot to try and go into the technicalities too much, probably contains a certain amount of a certain quota of silicon as its principal element. The inside may be sort of a gaseous mixture or partly gelatinous, but mostly it's space. That they will adopt certain forms, particularly the globular, the lenticular, i.e. the saucer, the oblate spheroid, I think it's called, the cylindrical. Perhaps when they're breeding, they will adopt, like I have seen myself under the microscope, and there are photographs of the splitting of a cell in mitosis. Have a look at it sometime. The chromosomes, how they bunch themselves together, and they put out sort of strings between the male and the female one, which you say, or the X and Y. And they put out sort of strings, and all the chromosomes bunch together, and then they join, and then they split in the middle the other way, you know, so we get so the generations are passed on to each cell. There are small sea animals which come together at a certain time, and when I say the animals, these minutiae that I'm showing you here, the amoeba does it. Two amoeba will sort of flow together and insist, to say, make into sort of a bigger one, and then they'll lie retrofit, and then the skin bursts, and out come lots of little ones. There are other kinds where two come together that are sort of plate-like, and they seem to throw out under the microscope little threads between them that makes like a little cylinder, X being at one end and Y at the other, and then they rest in that stage of time. And then out of them come little pairs of little things which don't look like either the cylinder or the two parental objects. A better description of that I have never heard than given by Mr. Michel in the cases reported from all over the south of France. A sort of cylinder appearing in the sky for some hours, and little pairs of things coming out of it dancing around in pairs, but whenever two of them touched, there was a blinding flash, and a lot of this stuff called angel hair came tumbling down. We'll get to that in a minute. His theory, and very much my theory, is that not all UFOs, but that there may be a very large class of life forms living on the outer edge of our atmosphere, which are hardly life forms. In other words, they're entirely for natural phenomenon. There could be such things. Now, everybody says, well, that's all very well, but wait a minute, why don't we see them? Well, I am not good at optics. But you know perfectly well that most of our telescopes are trained on things outside our atmosphere. Most of our meteorologists are straining their eyes on things inside our atmosphere. We are working like mad now, so is the Air Force, Everybody is to find out what goes on at the edge of our atmosphere. But nobody's going to turn around and tell me that things haven't been seen floating about in the sky. They have. And they are of just the type of form which, due to the natural environment, a natural object is, which is not an inanimate object, and is neither an animal nor a plant nor a virus, but is, in other words, a life form, might take up. Then people say, well, wait, come, some of these things are of enormous size to be reported. I'll take that up in 1 second. Then they say, how do they travel so fast? Well, I'm no good at figures either. I should have made some notes before I came. I'm sorry, John, but I will give them to you, and if you want them read on the air, I can either read them or I can send you a note and you can read them yourself. If you take the density of water as a medium, and the pressure of water at the bottom of the ocean, and at the top of the ocean, and you compare it with the density of air at ocean level, and then on up through to our outer atmosphere, and you extrapolate, as it were, from what figures we have in water into the air. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. An animal of such and such a size, traveling in the medium known as water, can develop a certain amount of energy only within its muscles. The most efficient of all is probably the blue whale, which is just one great huge hunk of muscle, actually. And it can go at a tremendous speed. Think of a thing 113 foot long jumping clean out of the water. It can go at a certain speed. In the atmosphere, in the lower atmosphere, things can travel much faster. Birds, for instance. As the atmosphere rarefies and goes up, the things can travel much faster still. And by pure extrapolation, according to Mr. Wessel-Ozelewski, and he said himself, he said, we've got to get somebody to go into the actual details of these figures, but about it. You can multiply the speed of something in water by 700, I think, and you will get the speed at which an object of the same size or comparable size can travel in the ionosphere. Also, a matter of size. The harder you're pushed on from around, the better it is to be small. I mean, the looser the medium around you is, the bigger you can be without upsetting things. Enormous sizes reported to some UFOs are not at all outside the bounds of a life form living in a rarefied atmosphere and feeding exclusively on the radiant energy.
Now, may I ask you just a question that occurs to me? Following your thoughts now, is it conceivable that as this life, if this life exists,
life form
exists, as it gets closer and closer to the light source, which on Earth our plant life uses, it could conceivably move it at the speed of light?
That's a lovely thought. I haven't gone that far. It's not one that anybody's brought up before. That I would have to ask some serious-minded physicist like Dr. Higginbotham or somebody who does have a slight interest in the biological aspects of these things. I may make a note of that and forget it for the moment so I can remember it for myself. It's a great thought. But I would, in the meantime, like to try and confine myself to the bounds of possibility as well as possibility, everything's possible, probability of the surface of our planet and its atmospheric envelope. As we know it at the present day, we're finding out a lot of things about it which we didn't know before. You know, the old idea was the further you went out into space, the colder and colder you got. Well, as you know now, there's a great layer up there that's real hot. Please let me stress and stress again that I do not say that all UFOs could be or must be or may be or are to be explained by this theory put forward by this fellow originally. On the other hand, I'm going to give you some real shockers anent this particular theory. I can't have the time or the facilities to put over the theory without visual aids and an awful lot of discussion and explaining myself, and I'm sure all of you are itching to get at my throat and say, well, what about this and what about that? I'm only trying to give you the conjecture which goes behind this theory, and I believe thou me, it is quite a theory, but quite a lot to it. There are certain aspects of it which has made me more deeply interested in this. In this aspect of UFO than any other, but has made me work more on it because I am a trained biologist, and my whole life is with animals, with life forms of one kind and another. I would just like to point out a number of different ways in which UFOs, as described by the poor, long-suffering, bleeding public who've seen these things throughout the ages and have scoffed at, take heart, dear soul, because the number of things that some of your UFOs, you report as doing, are the natural habits of life forms, particularly of animals, as a matter of fact. I live with animals, I know. Don't think that animals, we're the only animals in the universe that have intelligence. If you've ever watched a cat stalking a mouse or a bird, both the bird, the mouse, and the cat are certainly using intelligence. An intelligence of a very advanced form. The cat is thinking out his next move. It's not all instinctive. And if anybody can tell me the difference between instinct and reason, they'd better get on the air right sharp and prove it. Now, take some of the things that these creatures do. I'll come even to the sudden stops and turns. Any animal, any life form which could travel at 15,000 miles an hour. And some of these things have been alleged to do just that. People, 90,000 people say, well, this is absolutely ridiculous. By extrapolation of what animals can do in a liquid medium, or burrowing under the earth, start with moles and things, how slowly they get along. So moles go rather rapid, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, things burrowing along under the earth take a longer time. They have to shove their way through. They have to use a lot of muscular energy. Animals in water can travel faster and more freely. Animals in air can travel faster still. If you get up into practically nowhere, they can travel at enormous speed. And that wonderful point that Sylvia brought up, which I'm going to think about very deeply, is it not possible that the closer they get to the source of their energy, the faster they may be able to go? Of course, I've got some nasty ones coming in a minute when we come to another aspect of ufology. That is the whole question of teleportation and the possibility of transgressing the speed of light, which, as Einstein said just before he died, is only a theoretical point. Just the same as the speed of sound is a relative point. I remember when I was a kid, I was told that no aeroplane would ever surpass the sound barrier because air became virtually solid at that point, and it'd be like driving an aeroplane into a brick wall. Of course, all the silly people who were telling me had all forgotten that bullets and things had been going through it for a very long time. It'd been overlooked, that's a fact. Unless this business of running into a brick wall, incidentally, will bring me back to what I'm talking about UFOs. You know the ordinary cockchafer or June bug, the big beetle which comes bobbling along? It is made of stuff, it's a natural plastic, it's exoskeleton, the hard shell that it's in. But it is, it's very less than a bead. It's something of a millimeter in thickness only. And yet, one of those beetles can drive straight into a brick wall at up to 50 miles an hour, bang into the wall, fall down on the ground, get up and walk away. I'd like to see some of our
beetles travel at the speed of 50 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah. There is a lake.
You just say, oh, yes.
Oh, there's insects that travel at enormous speeds. But the surface flies. There's a certain surface fly. You know that when you go into a pine wood and you see this thing looks like a yellow jacket just hovering in the air and suddenly it's somewhere else, sort of egg beater style, helicopter thing. It was alleged by one scientist, and of course he was immediately slopped on the head for having said so, but I believe that he wasn't too far off from the work of other people, was alleged to have been able to travel at 800 miles an hour. Well, that's before anybody had broken the sound barrier, and there was an uproar. It's supposed to live on the top of the Mexican mountain. I don't know. I bring it up more as a joke then, because he did say it in scientific print, and he got walked. That was the end of him for a time, but they have found that animals do travel flying. Animals, the insects, the smaller they are, the faster they can get along, and the beetle is a pretty fast thing, very inefficient, but still. But I'm thinking of the other aspect of it. Flying into a brick wall would make it only 40 or 30. You try driving your car into a brick wall at 40 miles an hour. I'd like to see some steel produced, which has the tensile strength of the material of which the outside shell of a beetle is made, considering how thin it is. We've got a long way to go. Anyhow, back to these UFOs, which those ones which might possibly be a life form. The enormous speed must be intolerable. Anything that can go at that enormous speed obviously does not suffer from too many G's, as it were, in acceleration. Also, if they can go so fast, they can stop so fast. And if they stop so fast, they can go off at another angle. In other words, they don't make a right angle turn. They come to a dead stop and go off in another direction. That is possible. But I don't think that this type really do that very often. I think that belongs to an entirely another category of UFOs. We deal principally with this kind. I'll get to dispose of them first. Just a few other points. I've shown you photographs of luminous animals in the sea, a fungus, bacteria, fish. Almost every form of life known has luminous members. I found a luminous beetle in a cave in Trinidad. I immediately got smothered for that. But all along the side of it, another scientist found light organs. And there are luminous fish. There is one bird, the young of this particular bird in Australia, little birds open their mouths to be fed. And sometimes the inside of the mouth is luminous, not because they are luminous, but because I have luminous bacteria have lodged in there. The theory is that the mother can find them more easily in the dark. There are sponges which are luminous. There are jellyfish. There are squid. Now, squids are particularly interesting. They are cigar-shaped. And they have, like, pot lights all around the side. And they are vivid. Some of the deep-sea squids that have been brought up, for instance, the Indian Ocean, have four different colored rows of pot lights along the side. If you like, I'll have to look through some more of these photographs and see some of those squids. There's a fish called Protoblepharos, which I caught when I was quite a youngster, in the Banda Sea, off the coast of the Moluccas. And, off the coast of Celebi. They went marvelous, sort of rather dreary looking little fish, rather sort of colder, just a bit like a porgy. And under the eyes, which of course fish's eyes don't have any eyelids, it has a sort of, like another eye, it's really a pocket, a sort of kidney-shaped pocket underneath each eye, with a movable lid, as it were. And in this pocket, in some extraordinary way, this fish manages invariably to gather an enormous amount of luminous bacteria, which just live in there like a sort of parasite, live happily there, glowing away all the time. And when the fish wants to see his food on the bottom, he simply opens his little shutters and he gets two little headlights pointing down onto the ground. It's the most amazing thing to see. We had some in a bucket. And it was all dark. Suddenly two little headlights came on so he could see the ground in front of him. Now, I come back to the luminous squid, for instance, who have these port light effects along the side. You'll see others there. That's a wonderful stop and go bug, which has red lights for going, for stopping, and green lights for going, presumably. It really does have red and green lights on it. It lives in, all the time inside a dark log in the Brazilian jungle. Now, a lot of these UFOs have been reported to have these brilliant port lights along the side, some of which are circular, some of which are lozenge-shaped, some of which are square, and the pilots have described the lights as being so darn intense it looks like a mercury flare inside, the Whitted case, for instance. So the idea of light forms having self-luminosity or carrying their own light is not in any way beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, it's highly probable. Now, if these things get their food, their energy, and were evolved to live in rarefied atmosphere, or even perhaps just that maybe right outside the atmosphere, actually in interstellar space there may be things drifting about. After all, if they can feed exclusively on energy, and we know there's matter all through space now in a very tenuous form, they might be able to pick up enough matter to make a sort of sphere, you see, or whatever other shape, cigar or lens. And it is interesting that many, in fact, nearly all cases report that the outsides of these animals look more or less like aluminum. Most fish have a sort of silvery look, don't they?
Very true.
They might think like the devil if they came down too low and got drowned in our atmosphere. They would drown, probably, in our atmosphere. This is a non-technical way of putting it. If they've come down too far. On the other hand, another aspect of this fellow's theory is certainly delightful. These things have always been seen in the sky. They sometimes drift down. Maybe they get sick and go down, like when whales go, when squids get sick, they come up. But they have been appearing, if you take a map, and map the appearance of UFOs, as Dr. Davidson said last night, they're always turning up in radio beams. Also, they occur much more frequently over atomic energy plants, over large cities, exactly, over all the places where we are broadcasting, telecasting, putting out masses and masses of electromagnetic energy, which didn't in the olden days used to be put out of these places. These things get their food from above. If they begin to get a certain food from below, they, being life forms, come down to do a bit of investigating. Maybe they can come down with a very strong radio beam, and they, in the radio beam, pick up a certain amount of electrical energy from that, but they need very little, being so tenuous.
Would they affect our radar?
Naturally, they were. They're solid objects. They may not be very solid, but they are. They're not hallucinations. They're things. And, of course, they would affect our radar if they picked up a spit. Also, they deserve the perfect explanation of the Foo Fighters. Also, I was in a couple of intelligence services for 10 years before and during the war. Naval intelligence for the Caribbean. And I had definite instructions from on high to please stop reporting green light. We thought that they were the enemy signaling to each other. What happened was really blew it up was this in the end. One of these green glowing objects landed on a road in Curacao when 500 British troops were marching from Wilhelmina Port up to take over the oil fields after the fall of Holland, and landed in front of the officer on the road one of these things. And I don't know whether the officer, being a good Britisher, said charge or forward men, but anyhow, they chased this thing, and it played tag with them. It would bounce along and disappear into the gutter, run along to the culvert, duck through and come out the other side, and sort of wait for them, and then run away in front of them. And it finally just went up the sky and disappeared. And from then on, the Admiralty decided that these things, most of the green lights, are probably natural phenomena. Indeed, they are. Now, Foo Fighters, the activity of that thing, the activity of the Foo Fighters, and much of the behavior of many UFOs is exactly that of an animal. They are inquisitive. And when people say they seem to be intelligently controlled, they are, because all animals are intelligent in a matter of degree, even a bumbling opossum. And anything that can move at high speed has probably got to have some kind of intelligence. Of course, it's a bad word, because maybe they'll be able to find it. But in other words, they are intelligently directed from within, do you get me? And they come down and play tag with the aeroplane. Wonder what they are. This smell of metal. They're giving out energy all over. Come bounce along and pick up a little food while we're on the way. These funny, great, bubbling things that come up. You know, all the things that come up from the bottom of the sea, we're amazed. And then, whoa, look at this interior thing called a kraken. We've got, it's now known as Archaeopteryx, a squid, which can grow with its tentacles up to over 30 foot long. For years and years, it was laughed at as a sea monster. Now, every museum has pieces of them. In fact, they use them as the bait for the codfishers out of the Grand Banks, have done all the way through. But one Professor Verrill could probably actually go out there and catch one. But we're amazed at some of the things that come up from the bottom of the sea, some of these deep sea fish. These things are probably just as amazed at giving them a morbid connotation. But they're looking for food like everything else. And they're not going to run into a plane. They can move much faster than the plane. They can play around with it, dodge away in front of it. A lot of these other things have come down low, like that poor scoutmaster who was reported to have got seriously burnt by one of these things in the Florida swamp, do you remember?
Yes,
you
ain't even heard of it.
Well, now, take a life form feeding on energy. It must be able to store energy. Electric eels can store, oh my goodness, what a lot of electricity can store in storage batteries. These things are little powerhouses of their own. Coming down here, buzzing around the Florida swamp, maybe got lost or tired or sunk to the bottom or got in a wrong convection current or something. And he's floating down there, feeling probably quite uncomfortable because there's tremendous air pressure around him, which he's not used to. And I'm making this far too human, but you see, I'm trying to explain animal intelligence and behavior, rather. Behavior is a better word. And up comes a human being, and out of all innocence goes up and gets too close or even touches it, and whammo! He gets a terrific electric shock. I'm using the word electricity to, again, oversimplify, because the different types of electromagnetic waves that are, the range is enormous. And so there may be one kind that feeds in this wave range, another one here. There may be thousands and hundreds, perhaps millions of different kinds of these creatures. And their behavior, I say, is definitely that of a life form. And I could go on indefinitely giving you such cases, such correlations between reports of UFOs and animal behavior. But now let me cut that out and say I would not attempt to put any percentage on those which I think might be life forms. I try to be objective and particularly scientific. I'm interested, in other words, in the exploration, the investigation of the unknown by the use of personal imagination, secondly by hypotheses. We need facts. I don't know if anybody's got a UFO yet. I very much doubt if this animal type or this life form type could be gotten. Because apparently, when they get down to our atmosphere, they dissolve. They proceed to dissolve. And sometimes when they clash amongst themselves, there seems to be a discharge of some kind, and this angel's hair comes down. You know the case of the policeman in Philadelphia? We saw it land on the pavement. He made sure of it. He went over and picked it up. I can bring you four or five witnesses from up in our Warren County who saw a similar thing, and they went and picked this stuff off the trees. And you know the old saying that it's migrating spiders? And they put out a web and then they go blowing on it. Well, it's a spider's web. You can tell spiders when put on the microscope. It's a string with little drops of oil on it. This stuff, they picked it up, and as they put it on their hands, it becomes jelly. And then it just seems to dissolve right inside you. Other people, I believe that Donald Kehoe has some locked up in a bottle or had some at one time. And when it was let out, it has no structure that we can find. I don't know whether he's had that analyzed. I think two or three people have tried to do it, but they never even get it to a lab. It just dissolves inside you. It goes away. In other words, it dissolves in our atmosphere. This Lapwood case was very interesting because we suddenly discovered that those things there, which look much more like machines, I must admit, come over the mountains and hit an updraft. There have been big forest fires, Monsanto chemical, all those collieries, and the atmosphere at the crest of the mountains where they came over was highly charged with carbonaceous matter. And they seem to be unable to cope with carbonaceous matter in a gaseous form or particles. They may have clogged their breathing vents, be they machines or animal life forms. And they all went out of gear at the same time. One managed to land, two got away because they were on the outside edge. Don't forget it was number one and number six who did so, keep on going. And the other two crashed and one blew up in the air, or he sort of came apart in the air, came unstuck. And the ashes that fell out, as Mrs. Williams saw, was nothing else but the beginning of angel's hair. Or, as Charles Fork says, there have been rains of substance which looked exactly like blood, there have been rains of ashes, there have been rains which would show a certain carbonaceous content. Supposing you had one of these things a mile and a half long, it might be so tenuous that you could, without the energy stored in it, you could drive a plane through it, and you'd only come out with a sticky mass all over you. But still, there's an enormous amount of material in there in a very tenuous form. Supposing it died. I suppose they die sometimes when they run out of energy or something goes wrong with their mechanism. I mean, when I'm speaking of biology, biological mechanism, when it runs out, they die, and what are you left with? That amount of carbon, silicon, and so on. And the end product, as it falls very rapidly through the increasingly dense atmosphere, will burn up just like a meteor. And all you get is ashes, of course, hence your rains of carbonaceous matter. Your rains of blood may be of a similar nature. Maybe the heavy part may have a certain amount of liquid in it, and so on and so forth. It's your umbrella. All right. Let us, for pure theoretical purposes, let us say that 80% of UFO reports are dealing with life forms. Or they are. Get them out of the way. There is no we come to another whole group, then, or the possibility of another whole group. There's no reason whatsoever why there should not be other intelligence, other forms of life in the universe, of the level of our intelligence, or above it. And nobody can deny the possibility that intelligence of our level, or higher, right up to the almost godlike, need not be contained in a body such as we have, made of hydrogen and carbon, principally, which is highly suitable to our planet, but on other planets, not necessarily going around our sun, going around other suns. And in the, how many suns are there in our galaxy of the size of our sun? I think it's 400 million or something, or 400,000 million or something like that. In our galaxy alone, and according to the theories of Kuiper of Chicago and Weizsäcker of Germany, planets are a natural concomitant of the formation of a sun. When the sun starts as a whirling lentisol disk, as it contracts, the heavy matter flies out like a centrifuge, and the light matter goes to the middle and makes the sun, and automatically, by a very complicated thing of worlds, you'll eventually gather up all the heavy matter and make the planet. And there will always be a set of planets going around every sun. Well, every sun the same size as ours probably got a set of the same number of planets, but about the same average size, according to Bode's law, anyhow. I throw that into the benefit of the astronomers. And the third planet out will probably be very equivalent to Earth. There is such a thing in nature known to biologists as parallel evolution, you know. One animal living on one continent can, over millions of years, due to the same things that it has to do, develop into looking almost exactly like a completely different animal on another continent. They're not related in any way, genetically, but they come to look almost identical. That's called parallel evolution. There's no reason why even human-like looking mammals couldn't be developed on a planet going around another sun of the same size as ours. The sun is being made of the same material as we know through spectroscopic analysis and so on. Therefore, there's no reason why there should not be life forms with intelligences such as ours, who, in other words, who can build machines, who would want to build machines, and who might go flying in them. We cannot discredit the possibility that there could be, in other words, man, and I've used man in quotes, man
and UFOs, which are machines, structures, guided by an intelligence either riding in that machine or controlling it robotically from a distance from a mothership. There is no reason why that category could also not be included.
This has been a presentation of the tape recorder UFO Information Service, a nonprofit organization, and Dr. A.G. Ditmar, General Coordinator, H.M. Henriksen, Technical Director.